Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Rustin Robert Young.
That's me. I'm here, everybody.
So, Justin, I've been reading, I just finished the William Goldman book. William Goldman, who is one of the most celebrated screenwriters, our most successful, prolific screenwriters. I mean, screenwriters don't really get celebrated. It's one of the sad facts of our culture. But he did everything, Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, Princess Bride, and many other films. And one of the things he talks about in there is just the fact that you read reviews of films and we don't talk about screenwriters. It just, they don't get much mention. And even really good reviewers like the late Roger Ebert, you could read an entire review of a movie and never see a mention of the person who actually wrote the thing and probably came up with the bits.
Yeah.
He cited in his book, his Tales from the Screen Trade. I think that was the first one. One of the things he mentions is a source for this was how people decided to elevate Alfred Hitchcock to the level of auteur, the idea of making the director the center of it and attributing all of the creativity or all of sort of the successes or the things that work to the director and sometimes the failure. And it started with Hitchcock, that when they wanted to say, hey, here's this person who's this doing, you know, this amazing work, but most of his really successful films, you know, he didn't write.
Yeah. You want to know what's interesting is also like there seem to be moments in our culture for which we do reward, if not fetishize, the do-it-all person, you know, like singer-songwriters became, you know, just the way that you became a rock star. You know, they were looked at as something more than in music through the 60s and 70s. The idea of having other people write your songs was, you know, looked at as like a tiebreaker of like, oh, well, they write their own songs. They're more important. You know, we look at Quentin Tarantino, Wes Anderson, Spike Lee, like, you know, Kevin, even someone like Kevin Smith, and say, okay, well, they get, you know, extra billing because they're writing their own material as well as directing it. It's interesting to see what bonus points culturally we give credit.
Yeah, and, you know, there are people that we lump people together, too. Like, as you point out, you know, you take somebody like Tarantino or Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
Who, you know, for... I think Wes Anderson writes most of his own stuff.
Yeah, he's collaborated with people. I think, but the you know, I just talk like this, man. The Wilson brother.
Yeah, and then I guess the Wilson. Grand Budapest Hotel. The screenplay credit goes to Stefan Zweig, who are inspired by the writings of Wes Anderson. Wrote the screenplay, so Anderson is the screenplay, you know, writer on that, and. It is, you know, it is curious to me because it is this habit we have of sometimes you see these directors, you go, man, they knocked it out of the park this time. And nah, not so, you know, like the last part fell apart for me. And it's the screenplay. It's very often the screenplays where these things do or do not work. You know, the Coen brothers write fantastic films and, you know, they write them for the most part. And they've written stuff for other people. But often enough, we attribute success. Like, again, Jurassic World made me think about this because I think Trevorrow did a really good directing job with that, but the screenplay, you know, Joffe and Silver were the ones that did, hey, you know what else that I really liked that was a cool remake? Those Ape movies. Guess what else the people who wrote that screenplay wrote? Oh, those things. And they go, ah, there's the connective thread.
And you see so much of like, okay, well, these guys get what movies, what big budget movies are. Now, they're the best ones. The ones that really resonate with us are big spectacle films with fairly linear plots that are just that 10% more complicated than they need to be. You know, that they're just a little bit more challenging. You have just a little bit more pathos. Like, I really can't say enough where, like, you don't really need that much of a plot device to get the kids on Jurassic on the island for Jurassic World, right? Like, they just need to get there, and now we have our you know, we care about these kids getting to safety. But the idea of how they got there and why their parents weren't with them and you know, why they were relying on the sister to take care of them, I think brought something, really did bring something to that story. It was really cool and really smart. And that's something that is all there on the page. You know, that's all that the screenwriter duo putting that there for us.
They had, and it's interesting because we talked about this before, that Bryce Dallas Howard's character had an arc. The kids had an arc. Chris Pratt's character really didn't have an arc. You know, he was pretty much the same guy at the end of the movie he was at the beginning. That's nothing wrong with that, but it was just sort of an interesting thing to see that everybody else had this sort of thing that developed, yet the guy who's presented as the lead. Love Chris Pratt. Chris Pratt was great in it, but it was just that you go, oh, yeah, he's that guy there. All right, I'm going to read these things out for you. Sabrina, The King and I, North by Northwest, West Side Story, The Sound of Music, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Okay.
Black Sunday. What do they all have in common?
The same screenwriter?
Ernest Lehman. One guy wrote all of these movies. Yes.
That's amazing. You know, and there was something, if you follow Max Landis on Twitter, he had a really interesting conversation about, you know, and part of the reason why I think that we do have a complicated relationship with giving credit to screenwriters is a lot of times screenwriters feel jaded about the final product, you know, mm-hmm. on what they turn in versus what comes there on the screen. And, you know, Max Landis's point was that, you know, for anybody who, especially with big budget movies, people who criticize screenwriting on big budget movies, he was quick to say, well, do you really think that a lot of this is like, you know, that a lot of these changes get made by the studio? They get made long after a screenwriter has turned in their work, especially with big budget blockbuster movies. You oftentimes have two, maybe three teams of writers that mm-hmm. come in and often, you know, they only settle on credit for X amount of them. But the process is complicated to the point where maybe even the screenwriters don't want to have their name on certain stories.
I think there's something to that. I think when it's a success, you know, you probably do. And I think that does where that was sort of my kind of question for Goldman, is that how often, I think that part of it comes down to that. So many of these things you do hear about people having their hands on it and this, but he makes a point though, that often what happens is you have a screenplay, and you're like, oh, and I'm going to paraphrase here. Like, oh, we want Clint Eastwood, or we want George Clooney for it. Well, George Clooney has his script doctor, has his guy that he wants to go in there and go make changes for it to make it better for him. They may not have made it better, but they're how you sell it to George Clooney by letting his guy go in there. Now, this guy gets a credit. And they're like, ah, you know what? We really want to get Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
Great. She's got her guy or her woman who she wants to go in and punch it up yeah. a bit, you know, basically make her part bigger and better. And then maybe the film falls apart because Clooney doesn't want to do it because of the changes. And a lot of times those changes aren't really invited. They're more to satisfy the egos of the stars.
And certainly so. And you got to wonder, you know, where, and let's circle back to Jurassic World, that Jurassic World, the part for Chris Pratt, which is this kind of supersized version of the Muldoon character in the original Jurassic Park, along with kind of the humanity of the Grant character as you know, his arc eventually gives us to by the end of Jurassic Park. It's kind of this hybrid, but you're right. It doesn't, he's kind of straightforward. The guy he is at the beginning is the guy he is at the end. And you've got to wonder whether or not, in the second movie, I think we're going to get a lot more of who he is and put him maybe more in the center of what this next Jurassic World story is going to be, because Chris Pratt, you know, was not the star that he was by the time that Jurassic World came out, at the point that that script was created and that movie was being shot.
Yeah. It's a very interesting road. Now, there's a... Do you ever heard of there's a guy named remember there's a guy in Buffy, you watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah, not all of it, but I'm familiar with it.
A guy named Devin McLeish?
No, I'm not familiar with him.
So he was a character that reappeared in like 6 or 7. He was a vampire hunter who had a secret crush on like Billy Lane or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So was present in there. And, you know, you think about the life of an actor in Hollywood is can be challenging because you're waiting to get these opportunities, these roles. And here's a guy that plays, you know, a character that's a minor character on a very successful cult favorite sort of show. And then after that, he did, you know, like some sequel to self, some smaller things like that, you know, little bit parts there, but really did not have much of a big film career as an actor after that, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you find yourself in that sort of position. But we would know him most recently because he's the guy that wrote American Sniper based really? On the Chris Kyle book.
Huh.
Oh, and those sort of stories are fascinating to me. You know, when you hear about somebody who did, you know, American Sniper, Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood's an icon. You know, Clint Eastwood's absolutely an icon, incredible, you know, and, you know, I think an amazing, great director. And, but, you know, you think about, well, and then here's the guy that wrote that screenplay and found those moments, you know, and then here's another person that's a Blade Runner, Unforgiven, 12 Monkeys, right?
Yeah.
David Webb Peoples.
Huh.
You know, this is the guy that probably created one of the most iconic science fiction films of the 1980s in Blade Runner that, although not a huge success, certainly affected the way people looked at sci-fi and that sort of futurism, etc. And he went on to go and Blade Runner had, you know, a couple different people who contributed. Hampton Fancher is another one of them. But, you know, he also wrote Unforgiven, which revitalized the Western. Unforgiven just all of a sudden brought back a genre that everybody thought was dead. You know, Hampton Fancher, another one of the, you know, attributed screenwriters on Blade Runner. This is a guy that is a, you look at his acting pedigree, this is a guy that was on Rawhide, was just tons of stuff, appeared in the early Fugitive film. And then as a writer, Blade Runner, did The Mighty Quinn, wrote The Minus Man, which is a really, really cool thing. And he actually directed The Minus Man, which was sort of this neat serial killer film starring Owen Wilson, which is worth checking out. But because he's just, it's like Owen Wilson is a serial killer. But anyhow.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. You know, Hollywood is just an interesting example because it is the commoditization of storytelling and ideas, the scale of which, you know, we pay as much attention to few other things like it. The power of finding a beat, finding the moment, you know, eliciting that kind of emotion and understanding, especially in feature filmmaking, you know, that idea, the beat, the moment between a characters that has come up in somebody's head and put on a computer or a typewriter back in the day. That's got to echo so loudly, especially in the modern filmmaking. You know, you got to wonder, like, okay, are the audiences in Beijing going to jump up and start cheering because of this thing that I'm having happen between these two characters? Will that resonate in middle America? Will it resonate on the coast? Will it resonate overseas? How does it play when you don't exactly understand the dialogue or the dialogue comes out, you know, mangled because of translation? Like, there's so much that kind of goes into it.
All right. Got another one for you. Color of Night, Volcano, Breach, State of Play, Hunger Games, Captain Phillips. Oh, Billy wow. Ray.
Same writer?
Same writer.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And he directed Shattered Glass. And he directed Breach. So he's got Secret in Their Eyes coming out. So Shattered Glass, I thought was a solid film. You know, I mean, tried to make sense of that story. Breach, extremely well done. Breach was about the mole within the FBI. Really, really, really tout. You know, I think it's, if you want to look at spy thrillers based on real life sort of events, it's up there. I mean, I would put it in my short list of just really tight films that just, you want to get a lot of drama out of two guys in an office and one guy just trying to get access to the other person's computer and not in a hackery kind of way and just worried this guy's down the hall or whatever. Tense, tense. You know, it was one of the things I loved about the original Tom Clancy movies. You know, you had, I think it was it Patriot Games? And you had the scene where Harrison Ford's trying to get information, trying to make printouts from a computer before the guy across the hall can delete them all.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get so much drama out of that kind of was it that or was it Clear and Present Danger? Yeah, it was Clear and Present Danger. That was the one. And so you get so much drama out of that moment when, you know, you look at how what they – when they redid the Jack Ryan movies and they try to make it kind of this Jason Bourne kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which it's just – it's not what it needed to be. You know, it's not – it was – there was such another cool opportunity for that. And let's see. Who is the – and that's problematic too is you're like, who wrote the screenplay? It's like, well, Steve Zaillian. Oh, so Clear and Present Danger. Here are the screenplay credits. John Milius was – looks like he was the first writer on it. And John Milius is incredible. This
legend,
is a guy
that did,
you know, just legend. Steve Zaillian, who, I mean, this guy's done so many interesting adaptations. Most recently, The Girl Who Played with Fire. He did Exodus. He did The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, American Gangster, Mission Impossible, the first one, Clear and Present Danger, Schindler's List, Searching for Bobby Fischer, Falcon and the Snowman, etc. I mean, it's just so many. It's amazing. Start looking at screenwriters, is what I'm saying. Start looking at these sort of things when you want to try to follow the quality or where really clever things often come from. That is a place to look.
Well, and it's always interesting to kind of see to follow those threads, you know, especially the ones that are, you know, have a string of movies, and you kind of see like, well, you know, now that you think about it, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Rise of the Planet of the Apes, like, dude. Do kind of feel like Jurassic World. And like, that's probably why I like Jurassic World and I like those movies. Like, there are these kind of elements and threads that you can often find movies that you might not have, heard of or ever seen that you will really like because you just realize that you're resonating with a certain screenwriter's taste.
Yeah. And that's a key. And you look at those success of the screenplays where they go, okay, what makes these stories the most, what is interesting about these stories? Not what, and I talk to writers sometimes and go like, you know, I would love to do a Jurassic Park movie where the dinosaurs were all dead, you know, they showed up and they're, and I'm like, well, that sounds like a horrible movie. Like, it may appeal to your intellectual hipster curiosity, but that's not entertaining. It's not why I go see a dinosaur movie.
Well, and you want to know what's interesting? And I'm curious to see where they go with the next Jurassic World is because I feel like I really liked – and I did like Jurassic Park 3, but it's been a while since
It was way better than the second one.
I don't know how it holds up, but there is just something to, like, those Jurassic Park movies are way more fun when they're in a functional park, right? Like the ones with, like, the remnants of the park, like – are just kind of they don't quite – there's something about that meeting of, like – the entertainment plus danger that just kind of is such a part of that franchise's DNA.
You know, I think that there's the third one, you know, where the third one was different was where it was its most interesting, like when they go into the pterosaur cage.
Yeah.
You
Which
know,
is
that
the,
was
the but is taken right from the book, right? It's one of the only action set pieces that isn't used in the original Jurassic Park movie, and they use it in Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah, and that was, and then the river boat thing, which was a thing that was, I think, in the first one too. So, like, there are a couple things that weren't in the first movie that they ended up putting in a third, and, you know, that was really cool because it was just this cool kind of, it's like, forget everything else, how we get into it or how whatever we get into it. Like, hey, it's foggy. There are these things that flap around and we don't quite know what they are or how they kill you or do whatever. And that was really cool. You know, it was just a really cool like thing. And that says to me, like, that's where there's a lot of different possibilities they can do that. And I loved in World was they set up that Dion Fierro's character. They talk about how, like, he took care of, like, you know, the Pterodon problem or whatever in Canada or something.
Yeah.
You know, implying they got away and, you know, they had to go shoot these things down, which apparently we live in a world where those things happen. And they did a really cool thing too, was that with the BD Wong character leaving with the embryos, is that happened like at the beginning of the third act or at the end of the second act. It wasn't this add on to the end of the film. It wasn't like at the very end, dun, dun, dun. Oh no, he got away. It's like, oh no, they got away with that way before. And so it's set up, it's there. They can go right into the next movie, you know, with that in play. But it wasn't, it was this, yeah, that thing happened. But we're really worried about surviving right now.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's not a film that is shy about what it is. You know, it's kind of, it's like, hey, no, we're going to do a lot of meta. You know, I think they go about to the line of where the winking would have gotten obnoxious with like, hey, we need bigger, stronger, faster dinosaurs because that's what the public wants. Like, we're talking about the park, not necessarily this movie, except we're talking about this movie because that's what people want. They want bigger, stronger, faster dinosaurs.
And just let me clarify, there are pteranodons in the cage. Let me just, I don't want angry letters from 5-year-olds.
But you know, it was so cool. I don't know. I dug that movie. I understand where, I mean, if people were disappointed by it, then that's fine. But you know,
well, yeah, I think that there is this, for a lot of the excitement of people coming out of it, it set up a thing that it's hard for that kind of, not impossible, but it's hard for a movie to live up to. And I went into it with, I want to see dinosaurs eating people.
Yeah. And also, it's like it's a movie that loves Jurassic Park. You know, it is just and I think it gets why it cares about it. It echoes it in the right kind of ways without trying to be the same movie. You know, it's its own. It is its version of the blockbuster that it needs to be in 2015, in the way that Jurassic Park was the blockbuster it needed to be in 1996.
Three.
93. Holy smokes.
Yep. Jurassic Park, 1993.
Yeah. And it has an escaping Jimmy Buffett with his two margaritas.
Yeah. And that was, God, I had a friend who was like, oh, I just hated how commercial it was with everything there. I'm like, have you been to a theme park?
You know? Yeah. I mean, that really is, I'm glad that they did it. I'm glad that it felt like Universal Studios. It felt like Disney World. Like, you know, there's the fact that the fact that like we're starting this movie with our main character giving a pitch to Verizon Wireless on sponsoring, you know, the new dinosaur attraction. Like, that's the most real thing in that movie, by the way. Like, that is the most, actually, those meetings are happening right now at theme parks around the world.
So do you have any predictions as far as where it's going to finally rest box office wise?
You know, I don't know. It beat Inside Out again this week. It beat Ted 2 this week. You know, it's already over 500 million. I think domestic, right?
Or yeah, it's a 500 million domestic. The next, it's number 5. The next one up is Dark Knight, which is 534.
So it'll beat that.
Yeah, it'll beat that. And then the big leap is to Avengers. It's $623 million domestic.
Which it certainly has a shot at that.
And then Titanic at $658. So can it do another $160 million domestic?
Yeah. You know, it's... Yeah, so here we go. Yeah, Jurassic World. It's got a shot at Titanic. I don't know if it has a shot at Avatar. Although, you know, you never know because with re-releases and stuff like that, like,
yeah.
But, you know, it just it shows you how powerful like the brand of dinosaurs are, right? Like, people just love dinosaurs.
Yeah, and it's people love dinosaurs, but we've only had one successful film franchise based off of them. And yeah. You know, and that's been, and even, you know, the extended sequences that, you know, that Peter Jackson did on King Kong, you know, were tedious.
Yeah.
In my opinion. You know, it's a movie that every now and then I go, do I want to watch it? I'm like, you know, there's nothing about that movie. I love Peter Jackson. There's nothing about that movie I love. There's nothing fun in it, you know. And it's a bunch of disposable people getting killed. It's what failed about Jurassic Park 2, you know, is really, you know, why Jurassic Park 2. There's not a sympathetic character in there other than borderline Jeff Goldblum. Everybody else is acting selfishly in their own self-interest or whatever, and you don't care about. And, you know, the guy, you know, and I've gone off this before, but Vince Vaughn's character, Nick Van Owen, is a horrible human being in Lost World. Horrible human being. He is the primary instigator to why everybody died, because out of his own sort of weirdo environmental ethics or whatever, that ended up getting people killed and getting dinosaurs killed and solving nothing. You know, he should have been tried on war crimes, you know. That was just so one of my many problems, that screenplay was just, it's like, there's who's good here, you know. And like, well, shoehorning in, you know, Goldblum's kid into there, and you get it, they're like, well, you know, the first one had kids in it, and I get why you want to have kids in it, and it's just the way they did that was just ugh.
Yeah, you know? They cut you from the gymnastics team.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it really is just, I mean, I'm happy for everybody that is involved in Jurassic World. The cast is really cool. You know, Chris Pratt, where are we at on Chris Pratt, man? That dude, you know, he's basically Han Solo in this movie, in Jurassic World. He is all, you know, a swaggering, cool guy with a heart of gold. You know, sky's the limit for that dude. He's just so likable.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to the key, is that he's a guy that's likable on screen, and he's a guy, when you see him in interviews and everything else like that, he comes across, you know, that way. And he's been a part now of a number of things that we love, you know, whether it be the Lego movie, Guardians, and you know, his character on Parks and Recreation. And, you know, I think next, what he's got coming up is Passengers in Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
These are
kind of gotta wonder where it goes. I mean, he has done a great job being a part of kind of these big franchise movies and knocking them out of the park. And I think he's gonna do great. I mean, I think that there is a part of the success of Jurassic World that is people like him. People want to see him being chased around by dinosaurs, you know. And to his everlasting credit, the biggest thing that people snickered at and made fun of in that trailer is him and the raptors, right? Which turned out to be a pivotal but smaller part of the movie than I think, mm-hmm. you know, the advertising might lead you to believe. But he pulls it off. Like that, yeah. I mean, like for how it's played and what it actually means and how it resonates with the plot. Like, it all makes sense. It's all there. It's not contrived, or at least in the way that we kind of thought initially, the cynical among us thought, like, oh, of course, now they got to make the raptors good guys because the raptors are such popular parts of the movies. It was really, really well done, and it's in no small part because you look at him and you feel like, yeah, no, he really cares about these raptors. I think Chris Pratt, the guy, really cares about raptors.
You know, it's funny, is years and years ago in talking about how we would do a Jurassic Park reboot or follow up. My biggest thing was the raptors were wanting to have, you know, somebody interacting. The idea is the raptors as team hunters, you know.
Yeah.
And whatever notion I thought of was nowhere nearly as well was well thought out as what they did here and how they handled it. You know, I thought that they're still goddamn raptors. I love that because I'm like, oh, I know what I want. I know why. As soon as I saw that, I'm like, well, yeah, of course. That's what you want to have. You want to take like the most fiercest bad guys you deal with before, and then you want to kind of have that alignment, you know?
Yeah.
And the way they did it here was, yeah, they're still animals, guys. You know, they are.
Well, we're wrapping up here. So, spoiler alert, real quick. If you have not seen it and you want to remain pure for the movie, then this will be the end. But just a very quick discussion on how the raptors were used in that movie. 3, 2, 1, light spoilers. Really, all we buy for the relationship that Chris Pratt has with these animals is at two pivotal moments, like 3 seconds of calm, you know, Like, yeah. And at one point it saves a life early, and later in the film it is the turning point, because Indominus Rex swipes at the raptor. He gets fed up with the raptor, but if the Rex does not hit the raptor, then you get the sense that the raptors would have just turned and ate him. Really, all they have is that 3 seconds of pause before they kind of continue to be the animals that they are. Like, it was really, really well done.
Yeah. Two things. One is, one of my favorite things was, I was one of the comment boards, is I saw somebody had, you know, it was the IO9. What was like, IO9 did this, what's going to be the biggest flop of the summer?
Oh, yeah.
And then they had the image of, you know, Pratt with the Raptors, like, you know, they weren't saying it's going to be the biggest flop of the summer, but it's like, what do you think will be the biggest flop? And we'll throw this one up there. And, well, you know, guess what? In the section, in the comment below, there are a lot of people ripping into Jurassic World. And then somebody put a image of Pratt on the motorcycle with the Raptors, but it was the image where they'd Photoshop motorcycles onto all the Raptors.
Yeah.
So it looked like they're riding. And you hear this person like, oh, man, no wonder. This is going to be horrible, you know, and just starts
that's
ripping it.
Funny.
It's like, well, idiot, that's not actually in the movie. But that was amusing to me. I'm going to give you a little ray of hope, a little ray of sunshine. Something.
Go ahead. We've had so much sadness in this episode. Let's go ahead and end it on a high note.
So, you know, we've talked a bit about, like, screenwriters and how much screenwriters can do. And, you know, and I know that one of the best tightly written screenplays that we've seen in recent times was Argo. And, you know, you would think from all the press and the PR and all that that Ben Affleck wrote it, but Affleck did not write Argo. He masterfully directed it, but it was written by Chris Terrio.
Huh.
Chris Terrio. Yeah. Do you know what Chris Terrio's next project is?
Well, I know he did the rewrite on Batman Superman, right?
There you go. So maybe.
Yeah. You know, let's very, very curious. Oh, real quick. That movie Passengers.
Yeah.
With adventure sci-fi. Do you know the story on that? What the plot is?
If it's the one that's been around for like 10 years, then I think so.
Traveling spacecraft to a distant colony planet, transporting thousands of people as a malfunction. One guy wakes up and faced with the prospect of growing old and dying alone, decides to wake somebody else up.
Oh, yeah, that, yeah. No, there was a different one. There was a different sci-fi thing called Passers. And then, yes, that is hilarious because that's the plot of Red Dwarf.
So there we go. Do you know who the other passenger that he wakes up is?
I forget, like ScarJo or
Jennifer Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence, yeah.
I am bullish on that movie's money-making capacity because they are probably the two most likable actors in Hollywood right now.
Well, did you follow the path of Serena?
Serena?
You familiar with Serena?
No.
Imagine I put Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, the darlings from the Silver Linings Playbook, in a historical Depression-era North Carolina drama. Sound
well,
like money to you?
I haven't
sound
heard
like
of it.
Money
it came
to you?
Out in 2014. Doesn't look like it panned out so well.
No, it didn't. It did not pan out so well. It was a, yeah.
Well, you know, this is a crowd-pleasing description of the story. In Depression-era North Carolina, the future of George Pemberton's timber empire becomes complicated when he marries Serena. Hold on to your butts, folks.
Yeah, it's that's sounds like a clear narrative I can just grasp hold of. So, folks, there you go.
Yeah, in terms of Chris Terrio with Batman Superman, I hope the movie's good. I hope the movie's really good. That's all I can really say about Batman Superman.
I hope so too. Well, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.